I'm Smith Called Keith, and you're listening to Fuel, where sales and marketing never sounded so good. Visit thefuelpodcast.com for all our shows.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Previously on Fuel.
We're currently camped out on the ground floor of Ridley Scott Pictures, and which is good, but within 3 weeks, we'll finally have a place of our own. Just in terms of anxiety at the moment and the sense of foreboding, it's not hit noticeably in terms of business, but that could all be about to happen. I think we wouldn't be doing this, and we wouldn't be doing another startup if it weren't really just for the fact that it's such an enjoyable way to work and to make a living, because it was bringing together that a strong, rigorous point of view on communications, but also how you make those communications live in the experience for customers.
This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Get fuel.
And we just feel it gets a little bit kind of, frankly, shallow when people say that, look, we can achieve these incredibly kind of, you know, the biggest problems the world is facing, you know, climate change, you know, discrimination, et cetera, through the mechanism of consumerism. Because that, and all the research we've done, tells us that that's a flawed hypothesis, basically.
Welcome all you pipeline junkies and creative marketing devotees. You're listening to Fuel, the new business show, and I'm your host, a Smith called Keith. This podcast is the only game in town if you want to stop off and fill up on mission-critical interviews about the world of marketing and the agencies that generate all that wonderful creative communications that make advertising, PR, digital marketing and content marketing one of the best and most exciting areas to work in. In this show, we've got a real treat for you. Ian Murray, the man behind the trilogy of reports that blew the lid off the world of marketing and exposed a potentially fatal weakness in its thinking. Ian's work, along with former guest Andrew Tenzer, highlighted how the creative industry's thinking and creativity could be missing the mark a lot of the time because people working in it aren't truly representative of the market they're targeting. Gut instinct, the empathy delusion, and the aspiration window rocked the creative world and forced it to think about how and why and where it's drawing its talent from and whether it needs to be revised. Personally, in a few years, I think we're going to look back on this and be so grateful that Ian and Andrew produced these reports, because left unchecked, the creative industries had the potential to get lost in its own echo chamber. But there's no denying the fact that this trilogy of reports, which I'll drop a link to in the show notes at www.thefuelpodcast.com, have had a significant effect on the recruitment policies, the thinking strategies, and the diversity needs of the global creative industries. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that Ian and Andrew's work is a landmark moment in the evolution of UK and US creative thinking. So, we've produced a trilogy of shows in Ian's honour. In part one, we look back at the effects of these reports, why he felt the need to highlight this potential weakness, and what other facts the reports found that he didn't publish. In part two, we look at the current work that Ian and his team are doing in the creative space and for clients such as LinkedIn. And in part three, we'll look at the role that research plays in client acquisitions, new business and creative strategies. Talking of client acquisitions, have you noticed that your new business activities dropped off recently? That all those clients you thought were going to green light projects for your agency have stayed on red or amber? If so, you need something to unblock your pipeline, a sort of plunger for your new business, something to keep the flow of new prospects landing smoothly in your sales forecasts. Allow me to recommend The Advertist. Since 2014, The Advertist has been helping agencies find their next new client. And don't take my word for it, obviously I get paid to say this, but take the word of past and current clients, all who testify to the fact that they've won significant amounts of business because of The Advertist. All your new business prospecting managed in one place. Stay on top top of the latest breaking news, insight, people moves, tenders, mergers, acquisitions, blue chip and freshly funded companies, with all the contact data to help drive your next new business campaign. Email hello at theadvertist.com for a free trial. That's theadvertist.com. Right, so on with part one of the show. Here's me talking to Ian Murray about the value of research in agency growth. You know, with my guest this week, I'm beginning to sympathise with music legends who go on a world tour and all the audience wants to hear are the classic favourite hits and none of the new stuff. It must be so annoying to stand there in front of your buying public and for them to ignore your new creative works and demand all the oldies. Ian Murray is the research equivalent of a rock star, an all-seeing eye who leads the charge for House 51, an award-winning research and strategy collective based in Glasgow and London. He takes qualitative and quantitative, I knew I'd stumble over that, qualitative and quantitative research, and like a master distiller, he blends it with behavioural and social science to help clients better understand the world they're selling to. Last year, his company picked up Best Trade Body Research Award for his collaboration with Thinkbox on signalling success. And he's worked on a variety of clients such as LinkedIn, which we'll talk about soon, ITV, Coca-Cola, Mondelez, Sony, Kellogg's, MasterCard. I mean, bloody hell, there are some of the world's biggest brands. So let's just summarise all this by saying that Ian is pretty plugged into helping leading brands understand how their world and their customers think and behave. And yet, like the old joke goes about the world's best assassin, you shoot the one priest. Ian is perhaps best known for the multi-year storm that he caused in the advertising world with his collaboration with former guest Andrew Tenzer on Gut Instinct, The Empathy Delusion and The Aspiration Window. You see what I mean with my rock star analogy? So as much as we can, we're going to avoid endlessly talking about those three because Ian's research has been updated and the knowledge that he's got for the world's leading brands is so much more informed. And it's hard to believe how much can change in the 4 or 5 years since that time. So without further ado, let's get Ian on the show and let's bring him up to date with all the latest research and intel on Ian Murray, The Seeker. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Paul, thanks very much, Keith. I can safely say that's certainly one of the best introductions I've ever had. So thanks very much for that.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to come on the show as well, on a Friday afternoon as well. So I'm sure there are plenty of other things you'd like to be going. But I've been looking forward to squaring this particular circle, sir. So what's taking you so long?
Well, you know, it's just one of these things that, you know, we're very busy getting on, as you said in the introduction, the day-to-day work, you know. And I was looking at all the great kind of chats you were having with, obviously, Andrew, Steve Harrison and all those guys. And I just was thinking, well, come on, when's my turn? So here we are.
Well, it's good to have you finally on board anyway. And as I say, I mean, obviously we'll talk about the three that you're known for, the three research reports that you're known for, Gut Instinct, Empathy Delusion and The Aspiration Window. But I mean, the whole point, I have to allow you a rebuttal and a follow-on because, I mean, this is your damn research, isn't it? So, you know, I have to ask you, I mean, has the advertising industry learned anything from these reports, or do you think that it's kind of still displaying all this homogenous thinking and still making all these assumptions?
I would hope that it has learned something, you know, because, you know, the fact that I'm talking to you means that there's been incredible coverage and buzz around the work we've done, and hopefully it's very informative and it's confronted a lot of the kind of biases and assumptions the industry have. So certainly I hope that the industry has learned something. I doubt, and I wouldn't be surprised if not much has changed yet, because to be completely candid with you, what we're driving at here is some very deep kind of seated cultural kind of change that's required. And it would actually, frankly, you know, though it's been a couple of years since some of this stuff came out, that's not very long in the kind of scheme of things, you know, to kind of make some of the changes that are required. So I don't see a lot of change, and I'm to be honest with you, not that disappointed yet that there hasn't been, because if people are really understanding what's required, if they were turning around and telling me they'd figured it all out, you know, over the last 18 months or 2 years, I don't think they'd have understood the questions that we were posing to the industry, you know, and the depth of what we're trying to say, you know.
But, I mean,
so yeah, so I'm not surprised really, and I'm not criticising, you know, turning around saying, hang on, there hasn't been a completely, you know, a completely blank slate here, because it's probably a generational type thing. It's not a, you know, a 1 or 2 years thing.
Sure. I mean, it's a long-term fix. I mean, yeah. some of this stuff, but I mean, you know, obviously, you know, props to you for you know, making it visible in the first place and bringing it to everybody's attention. And I think that, I mean, I guess my point would have been, or my question should be really, I mean, you know, are the people that you speak to in the advertising industry, are they kind of more aware of what it is that you've brought to light? And, you know, do you think that it's making them second guess their work slightly?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I say, I think they're more aware of it. I think one of the things that's quite interesting, this is where we were joking, one of the other times we talked about the risk here is that I come back and then I double down on some of the stuff that's been said already. But you know, it's been very interesting to see how these, you know, pieces of work that we've done have taken on a life of their own, basically, right, as it's gone out there into the world. And of course, to if I'm not going to be too shy about extending your metaphor about, you know, kind of musicians or artists or whatever, it has given us a little bit of an insight into what it must be like when you see something take on a life of its own and have a range of interpretations that, frankly, you didn't necessarily intend in the first place. And I think there's been quite a lot of that. And some of that has been good. And then some of it, actually, I think, you know, highlights that still there's a lot of people that are talking about it but don't quite get, you know, what we're talking about, you know, and haven't quite, you know, internalized it, you know, how serious it is or what needs to happen to change things. And so, I mean, one of my personal bugbears, and this has happened to me a lot over the last couple of years, I go to, you know, mostly on Zoom calls, conferences or, you know, meetings or whatever, and there'll be someone in the room that'll start telling me when I talk generally about the work I'm doing, and then they say, have you read this thing called the empathy delusion? And they start telling me about what the empathy delusion means and about how, for example, it's about the London bubble, yeah? Or more broadly, a metropolitan bubble. And if only all the people in advertising could just get, you know, beyond the M25, they would figure all this stuff out, you know? And this is a good illustration of how that's not what the research is about at all. You know, we're talking about a much deeper kind of cultural and psychological problem than that. That isn't just about the geographical skew of the industry towards London or New York or wherever it is. You know, so therefore you hear a lot of talk in the industry about solutions that are about simply getting out there. And if I could only just spend more time in pubs in Newcastle, or I could open an agency in Stoke or whatever, you know, that would fix it all. And this is the thing, you know. So there is that sense that we were driving at a much kind of deeper cultural and, you know, psychological kind of problem. And I'm not sure that everyone has kind of completely figured out it's as serious as that.
Well, I guess that there is a large tendency to want to try and fix it. Like, you know, as soon as it's highlighted, you know, people go, okay, well, we, you know, let's think of a fix for that. So, you know, I mean, and like you said right at the start, you know, there's a very long tail to this whole thing, you know, and there's a sort of a long climb to, you know, to actually get there. But I mean, let's just shoot down one of the first big 600-pound gorillas in the room, you know, which would be that, you know, that we're working in an industry, or I'm working in an industry, and you obviously are informing that industry, you know, about in the creative industry, and its job is to drive a capitalist economy, and yet, you know, we're being told that a lot of the industry, you know, self-identifies as left-leaning. I mean, how can that happen? How can you do those two things?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the this is where we came in at with Steve Harrison, for example. You know, when I'm saying about how things take on a life of their own, Steve very much initially, I think, and I think he's developed his argument since, seized on that idea that what had really happened here, the essence of can't sell, won't sell, was the industry had somehow become anti-capitalist, and you know, and actually decided that, you know, it was for something else rather than the kind of the business of selling. Now, I think Andrew and I have to take some responsibility for that interpretation, because we did, in The Empty Delusion, make the point that you've just made, that, you know, there is an identification on the left in the industry, and that's true, that marketers tend to identify on the left more than the mainstream public they're trying to influence do. But we were very conscious, and you've been very good to use that qualifier, that it's self-identified. Yeah. So it's a persona or an identity that they have. But the thing that's interesting there is that I think there's a mistake that gets made between the different kind of forms of, you know, kind of values that go into that. You know, so for example, there's no doubt, and I don't think anybody's surprised to hear this, that the kind of people that work in advertising happen to be at the liberal end of the spectrum when it comes to kind of social and political values, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of, you know, believing in equality and diversity and, you know, a whole lot of freedoms like that. But the contradiction is that they seem to have then kind of, you know, projected that liberal set of social values onto this idea that businesses are the absolutely sharp end of driving, you know, capitalism and an economy, are the places where you achieve progressive social reform, right? And I think there's a couple of reasons why that happens. One, and we've made this point in the white papers, is that people just want to feel good about getting out of bed in the morning, right? You know, so, you know, thinking you're on the right side of history, you know, is a good way of kind of
getting yourself motivated to do
this. It helps you get on with the day if you think that there's some other kind of thing that offsets the hard sell, right? So there's that. But to be frank, and a lot of the work we've done at House 51 since these reports were out, is dug into this a little bit deeper. And unfortunately, there's another kind of, I suppose, blow for the industry, which is that one of the reasons this comes about is, frankly, they are what you might call either ideologically innocent or ignorant. So they don't actually really understand what left wing means. You know, and there's a thing about this in the whole of society. Does left and right as labels for what's going on really kind of capture the complexity of what's going on these days? So they're a shorthand that goes back to the French Revolution, frankly, you know. So is it any surprise that in the 21st century they don't completely, you know, kind of capture the, you know, what's going on? But what we find when we look at this in detail, and there's a thing called a political quadrant that some of the listeners might have heard of. And essentially what it does is it takes two dimensions of values. It has these social values, which are the ones we've already talked about, and they kind of go from what you might call libertarian to authoritarian. And there's no surprise that marketers are very much on the libertarian side of that. But the other side of it is the other kind of axis on the quadrant are economic values. And if marketing people kind of stopped to think about what the economic values of the industry were, they'd realise that those are very much on the right-hand side of the quadrant, because they're about, broadly speaking, you know, if you're about generating global, you know, profit for globalized, you know, businesses, you believe in a wide range of things like free markets and probably deregulation and things like that, which are very much on what might, in the broadest sense, be called things that are on the right of the economic set of values. And so then that's the kind of tension that isn't ever gets talked about in the industry. So I am liberal, therefore I'm left wing. But actually, the thing that really matters is there is what is the role that a business plays in society, and what is the role that a government plays in society, or a democratically elected institution as well. And that's where the tension kind of comes, is that they're focused on one particular part of the equation and missing, you know, missing this big thing that the, you know, you can't really square that circle of saying you're a reforming kind of, you know, revolutionary, you know, purpose-driven person, and then be going to work every day and driving global capitalism. There is a contradiction there.
A left-leaning capitalist. Really, yeah,
exactly. So that's the thing. So when we delve into that, then this is what you get. You get this real tension there that the marketers are, as we've said, and all the other stuff we've done so far, are very liberal and slightly more liberal than the mainstream audiences that they're trying to influence, but not that the mainstream are illiberal, just right. That marketers are very liberal. But where the big difference comes is they're working in an industry that's certainly about capitalism, and actually when you ask the mainstream and their economic values, it's quite an unequivocal rejection of capitalist economic values. The mainstream believe in, even, you know, when you ask them in the general, that they believe in governments that intervene in the economy, that regulate, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is where this idea that businesses can say to government, step aside and we'll sort out all the world's biggest problems, becomes something where there's another big disconnect with the mainstream audiences, because that's not how the mainstream want the world to be, and they don't believe that's how stuff gets done. So there is quite a big contradiction there.
So, I mean, are we looking to achieve a balance between how, you know, sort of, obviously we don't want big government, but neither do we want big capitalism either. So we're looking for kind of a sort of a middle ground in there. It is possible, I guess, isn't it? Because, I mean, you have social democracies and those sorts of operations in Denmark and Sweden and stuff. I mean, do those sorts of economies reflect that kind of thinking?
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think that's one of the points I make, is that, you know, the people that populate marketing it's a reasonably young industry, you know, that's the thing. And if you just think about the cultural and economic experiences these people have had, people that are in their 20s and 30s, what they've experienced is a set of, I feel like, common sense assumptions about how an economy works that are very much on that kind of, you know, dare I say it, neoliberal side of the equation. Right. You know, I mean, if you're about 30 years old, that's the end of the Cold War, and and what was argued at the time by people like Francis Fukuyama, the end of history. You know, that liberal democracy and the free market had triumphed, and you know, there's nothing else to talk about. So there is a thing that, you know, in some ways you can't blame younger people for having reference points that are different, you know, and don't realise that there are other ways. But the point is, they also are the people that have got a very, and this is when we talk about all this stuff, I'm very careful, and hopefully I'll get this across now, is we don't criticise, for want of a better word, social purpose in marketing, because we don't believe society needs to change and society isn't unfair and there's a hell of a lot of stuff that needs to be reformed. We do it because we're serious about that, and we see in marketing people that haven't quite figured out exactly how things work.
Right,
you know?
Yes, okay.
And so what we're saying is, believing that selling more toothpaste or whatever else is going to kind of achieve this kind of change, if you're serious about it, you need to really understand what the levers are that will affect change, and also understand what the role of big business is and where we are right now, you know. And so I think it's just about, we're arguing for people to be a little bit more conscious and deliberate about how these things can be achieved. And we just feel it gets a little bit kind of, frankly, shallow when people say that, look, we can achieve these incredibly kind of, you know, the biggest problems the world is facing, you know, climate change, you know, discrimination, et cetera, through the mechanism of consumerism. Because that, and all the research we've done tells us that that's a flawed hypothesis, basically, you know. So we're like, crack on, change the world, but get a better idea about how to do that.
It's very interesting. And the more that I've explored the argument about climate change and stuff, I mean, it becomes quite apparent that there, it's almost like, you know, opposite poles of trying to push, you know, magnets together when they're, you know, the opposite poles, because it's just never going to happen, because you've got, you know, you've got an economy that needs to be fueled by commercialism, capitalism and stuff like that, which ultimately is, you know, has a negative impact on the economy. And we can't all, you know, sort of turn around and, you know, and start and be market garden farmers and stuff like that. You know, there has to be somebody delivering that. So, I mean, we have to find a medium ground somewhere, don't we?
Yeah. And I think where I'm at is that, you know, I'm quite... What we try to do with the research is illustrate that. I mean, I'll come back to middle ground in a second, yep. if I okay. may, but just in terms of, you know, exactly that, about having an awareness of how the different pieces fit together and what the role of different, you know, actors are in the economy, right? And so we say that the government is an actor and, you know, business, and you know, is an actor as well. I mean, the thing is there's a basic thing, and take climate change. You know, if you go to work every day and you spend 8 hours a day or whatever and more in an agency, let's be frank, you know, basically trying to drive consumption, right? That's a fundamental contradiction with saying you're going to help the climate, you know,
save the planet. Yeah.
You know, consumption is the problem. You know, if we consumed less, that would be a big problem. So there's that kind of wanting your cake and eat it thing that really, frankly, you know, gets to me. You know, and a lot of the research is driven by in a very, very kind of disciplined way and with a lot of evidence and trying to, you know, make that point that just stop for a minute and think about what you're saying. We can't just switch off the economy, but frankly, don't insult our intelligence by saying we can save climate by consuming, because we can't, you know. A big thing is consuming less, you know. There's a lot of interesting stuff about, you know, the new cars that are coming out, electric cars, and we think, well, hang on, this must be good for the economy. Well, the bottom line is we're making cars now that can last if they're maintained for decades in a way they never could before. You know, cars used to rust a couple of years after you get them and everything. So these things last a lot more. So in that sense, they're more sustainable. But now we are saying that, hey, you know, let's get rid of all those petrol ones. And of course, there's problems with that, you know, fossil fuels and everything. And have these, you know, electric cars that need resources as well. Lithium is a scarce resource in the world and it needs to be mined. And also the cars we're making are like 30% bigger than they were 20 years ago. So they've got so much more resources going into them.
Right.
And it comes to a kind of stage where you have to say, well, look, you know, sure, it's a very important part of the economy, you know, transport, et cetera, and it provides a lot of jobs, et cetera. But we've got to come up with a more sophisticated way of saying we're going to help the climate than say, just buy more big, you know, ticket items like cars, you know?
I couldn't agree with you more on this. I think it's, you know, it's one of those interesting things that, you know, it does cause a massive dilemma. And I think that, you know, it's right to try and, you know, to try and sort of, to put that over, you know, in terms of, you know, you can have this, but there is always a payoff. You know, there's always going to be a, you know, a cause and effect, if you will. But okay, so now, okay, well, let's put the world to rights, okay, and we're, you know, we're 20 minutes in, so congratulations on that one, Ian. That's excellent. That's fantastic. Now, I mean, just quickly, was there anything in those reports that you didn't publish that you wish you had?
I mean, to give you an idea, there's probably about, my estimate would be, one, there's another one that's actually written, which hasn't been published. I've written another one that's fully formed that hasn't been published.
Right.
And then there's probably enough material for about another two or three. So there's tons of stuff.
Are you going
absolutely
to?
Absolutely tons. And basically what happens is, I mean, look, we're working for, you know, one of the biggest publishers in the UK. And of course, everything's an editorial decision.
Right.
So what we were doing all the way through is saying, look, we want to get this stuff across. We want to be challenging, but we need to make sure we do it in a way where we kind of try and take people with us and we don't just end up getting the turn off because it just like was too much. So I think the judgment we made was is that what are the things that will be interesting and challenging, but, you know, won't completely, you know, like feels everybody's, you know, how much of this stuff can they take, basically, right? So one of the things here when I have conversations like this, Keith, is I can talk about other stuff, but a lot of it is, you know, just like going even further into, you know, what we had before.
Right.
But there are things that I think we should have published. And I think one of the interesting things is that... even in what we did publish in the Empathy Delusion, I now think we should have had a different conclusion at the end of the Empathy Delusion. So there's an interesting thing for you if you want to hear about that.
Do tell.
So One of the places we land on there is when we've set up all, you know, this gap there is, you know, this kind of understanding gap and this cultural gap there is between the marketing industry and the mainstream audience are trying to influence. Once we set all that up, of course, we had the challenge and said, well, what can we do about it? You know, and as I said at the beginning of this, we're not expecting all of this to be solved in 5 minutes because it's deep cultural and kind of psychological stuff. And then we start thinking, well, hang on, one of the things we were driving towards is one of the reasons this disconnect happens is because of the social composition of the industry, you know, and this is what we talked about more in the aspiration window as well, that, you know, marketing draws its talent disproportionately from, for want of a better word, elite parts of society, skews very much towards higher social class, highly educated. And that's why we get a lot of the stuff we're talking about earlier about the liberal values and all these things that don't connect. So, and of course, one of the biggest themes there is, we've talked a little bit about the climate, one of the other biggest kind of problems we need to solve in the world is the problem of social mobility and the lack of diversity in the industry. Yep. So we landed on a place where there's actually, and I'm not retracting this, there's a connection there between actually the lack of diversity in the industry and the disconnects we see in how we understand the mainstream. And we talked a lot about one of the ways of improving the culture and the, if you like, the kind of cultural understanding of the advertising marketing industry was simply to have a wider range of people working in the industry. Right. So cognitive diversity and cultural diversity. And so the idea is, how do you change the thinking style? How do you change the biases that are in the industry? Well, one of the things you do is you just represent all of the biases and all of the thinking styles in the industry, and therefore you get, you get a spread that you don't have if you only pull from one place. Now, I still stand by all of that in the sense that diversity and, you know, solving social mobility and just from a social justice point of view is something the industry should be doing. And we're very strong on that. But it does occur to me now that I think we were letting the industry off the hook a little bit, because if I was being devil's advocate on what we concluded, I was saying that the people that had struggled already to get into this industry, get through the door, if we finally let them through the door, we're going to hold them responsible for changing the culture of the industry. And frankly, now I wish it had been harder and said it's the people already in the industry that have the responsibility to change that culture. And so now there's a whole lot of stuff that we did that we didn't go in there that was a bit more about. We talked a lot about biases and how the culture, you know, you go along with the culture. Everybody's assimilated into the culture. Yeah. And it's a lot of this is unconscious. And now I think if I was writing it again, based on some of the other stuff we had, I would go harder in saying that actually one of the solutions to this is frankly being a little bit more conscious of what's going on
from the
and
top.
Actually, frankly, just having a bit more critical thinking. And you're actually thinking, well, look, sure, managing your biases is hard, but effectively, you could say in a way that's exactly what advertising marketers are actually paid to do. You know,
that's the same thing.
I think we let them off the hook, basically.
Yeah.
Through making a diversity argument, we didn't challenge the people in the industry enough to say, hang on, you are paid to overcome this stuff and understand what's out there in the real world. And if you can't do that, you shouldn't be picking up your check at the end of the month.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff on that we could have put out that would be that, hang on, this is how we let you off the hook. And that might, some people that feel very challenged by the stuff that's already out there might find it hard to believe, but we could go stronger in that. And sometimes I think we should. And that was my comment earlier about the London bubble. That's one of the reasons that annoys me, because I think that's a letting yourself off the hook thing, because what you're really saying there is, this isn't my fault. You know, I kind of work in this industry where I go to cool bars and I hang out with other people that values have been, you know, dictated by the formative affluence they had as children and the good universities they went to. You know, it's just the world I inhabit. It's the air that I breathe. You know, it's not me. And actually, the fact is that particularly in London's the place I know best in terms of the agency world. And
right.
I spent a little bit of time in New York as well. And I think I could detect a similar thing going on in somewhere like Williamsburg or, you know, down in Tribeca or Soho. But, you know, these areas, and think about London, how the agency world is kind of drifting from Soho to Hackney and, you know, Tower Hamlets and Southwark, you know, and all these places.
Silicon Roundabout, yeah.
Yeah, Silicon Roundabout, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of cool and trendy stuff going on. But actually, if you look in the kind of, you know, you can Google this, anybody can do it that's supposed to be interested in, you know, how the world works. Tower Hamlets and Hackney are two of the poorest local authority boroughs in Europe. So this idea you have to, the London bubble is stopping you understanding what's going on.
It's right there.
They walk past all of this going on their way to their cool offices every day, you know, and it is literally a case of, not to be too fine a point on it, opening your eyes, and it's what you pay attention to, you know. And I think this is the thing I'm talking about. We were challenging, as you said, that's why we're talking here, you know. There's over the space of a few years, we've generated quite a lot of heat and constantly this, but I hear still a lot of this about the science and the psychology and the cross-cultural kind of frameworks we've used are getting used almost as crutches, basically. Right. And when it's actually, guys, you're paid to figure this out. Look out of the window of your agency in Hackney, you know. Don't go to the cool new kind of sushi bar. Wetherspoons and Greggs are available as well, you know, in London, you know.
So really, do we have to go to Wetherspoons?
You know what I'm saying? But, you know, just that kind of thing. So I think there's a lot of stuff about that we could have said, hang on, for want of a behavioral economics, everybody thinks behavioral economics is system one and system two. And there's a lot of the stuff we used was the unconscious system one explanations, you know, the kind of people not being in check enough of their intuitions and biases. But actually what needs maybe to happen a little bit more than this is they need to kind of dial up system two a little bit, right, and just, like, you know,
turn off the lizard brain and start actually analysing stuff. Absolutely. And,
you know, the primacy of emotion, well, that might be good for the advertising you make, but for the consumer, but actually the process of doing the work is a system two process.
And getcha.
Don't give vent to all your kind of impulses, you know. Sit down and you're paid to think, basically.
And we're going to leave it there for this show. Ian is so engaging and interesting to talk to. Thank you so much for being part of the show. We'll be back with part two in just a jiffy when we discuss some of the top secret work he's been doing for LinkedIn. This stuff is gold, I tell you, gold. For now, I've got a biz bounce, jog on and hit the road. I just want to say thanks to Team Fuel. That's Matt, Donna, Peter, and especially you, our splendid, passionate, creative and hardworking, wonderful listeners. Thank you all very much for helping us grow. Fuel is a proud member of the Marketing Podcast Network, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a network of marketing podcasts, a veritable smorgasbord of brilliant business, PR, digital content, marketing, sales and entrepreneur podcasts. So if you like this show, then check out all the others at marketingpodcasts.net. That's podcasts with an S. Or look in the show notes at www.thefuelpodcast.com. So ta-da for now. We'll be back next week on Fuel, the podcast for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you? I'm a Smith called Keith, and you're listening to Fuel, where sales and marketing never sounded so good. Visit thefuelpodcast.com for all our shows.